This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, from the studios of the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. With me from Connecticut, and before that, California, Barbara Quick, poet, novelist, Substacker. She's premiering new work today, and we're going to hear a poem right now.
Thank you, Grace. This poem is called Gift for My Newly Widowed Friend. If we learn now to speak the language of angels, death won't stop our conversation. I can't speak to you of loss in this language without feeling weighed down by the clay of my body. Will I learn before I die? This jar of jam is filled with all the sweetness to be coaxed from black earth and a thicket of raspberry canes. Marriage, in other words. I've made it not too sweet, so you can taste the foggy mornings and the nights when you couldn't sleep. I've sent it too late for you to taste it with him. It's winter now, and it seems these dry sticks can't possibly grow green and leafy, heavy with fruit. This is what faith is, knowing that the garden will feed us again.
That's the voice of Barbara Quick, and it is quite a voice. What is the title of this manuscript?
The manuscript is called This Dark Soil.
And what's it about?
It's all poems that I found in the garden.
You found these poems?
I did.
They're just under a rock.
Yeah, just under the dirt or just on top or under some leaves like little fairies. That's where I find them.
All about the garden.
Yes.
Tell us more.
Well, I've been an enthusiastic organic gardener and nature lover since I was in my early teens in Los Angeles. I cultivated a garden. I dug up the ice plant, planted along the roadside, and I planted tomatoes and peppers. I would just plant food wherever I could. And I'd also be in the habit of finding food and growing in the oddest places. At the marina at Marina Del Rey, I found watermelons growing. I mean, the earth is so abundant, and it gives us abundance. And we need to honor it and connect with it.
And you did that. You did that in this work. And so let's hear two more.
Okay. This is a poem that I wrote in Connecticut, where the autumns are so magnificent, something that I, as a Californian, had never experienced, I'd only dreamed of, and I love it so deeply. What the trees are saying, let them all let go. Every last one of these desiccated leaves that still cling to us. Let them find the courage to let the wind launch them on their first and last solo dance across the sunlit stage of air. Pirouette and grand jeté fluttering, joining the gypsy skirts that swirl around each mother tree. Let them make way for the swelling buds beneath the bark that masquerades as something dead. Let go. Let go.
What a message, and don't we wish we could let go. Now, you are a novelist, and I know you have four produced works and two that are ready to pop, and very well known for Vivaldi's Virgins and What Disappears, which are international and acclaimed works. So here's a poet and here's a novelist who are the same person. What sensibilities are different for the poet than the sensibilities needed for the novelist?
Well, at this point in my life, I feel that I've brought everything together. I've been calling it all in so that my newest novels, I think, are very written from that poetic sensibility, with that poetic sensibility, but also my poems have that narrative storytelling sensibility. So I guess I'm an integrated Gemini, maybe finally. Both these things have come together in my life, and that's what I'm trying to do.
But do you think it's always been that way?
I think that when I was writing fiction, I did not write poetry before. And when I was, you know, in a lull between novels, and there wasn't one for many years, I did write poetry. But I've written poetry since the age of 9, and my first novel was published when I was in my early 30s. So it's always, they've existed side by side.
Do they take turns?
Well, they did, but now, no.
But I mean, can you write a novel at the same time you're writing a collection of poems?
No.
Yeah,
actually,
that's what I wanted to know.
I can't.
Yeah.
I can't, because when I'm writing a novel, everything, every ounce of my everything, wisdom, sensibility, perception, all of it has to go into what I'm writing at the time.
Makes perfect sense.
Can't hold back.
Perfect sense. Have another poem, please.
This one is called Lately Heavy Rains. When the willows along the jogging trail hove into view, I put my dog on pause, unzip my fanny pack, and take out the mace, just in case one of the homeless men living rough behind the thicket is deranged or hopeless enough to hurt me. Mostly they stay hidden, and lately heavy rains have driven them away to shelters or camps beneath the freeway, where concrete makes a better roof than trees. Sometimes the dog holds back, put off by something she smells, and I turn us around before we get too close. But today, I'm drawn on by a sound in the air around the willows, whose fuzzy catkins have just burst into flame. A susurration of bees, hovering, diving, gathering, their legs heavy with golden packs of pollen, as if some merciful god had transformed the homeless men into honeymakers, hundreds of them, enraptured by our early California spring. And I stand unmoving, in the shower of sound, looking up through bare branches at cerulean sky, spying on the lucky miners flitting by. Drunk as the bees, as I pause in my run, convinced that cruelty can be undone, that spring will come and hope will once again be found.
Amen, sister. Amen. Well, you're writing and reading from a collection of works, which is your life's story in narrative poems. And it goes into many sections sequentially, chronologically. Now that you've completed that autobiography in verse, what do you feel you'll do next? Now, Camus says we're always writing the same story over and over, which I know in my own life is really true, and in every poet is true. So you'll always be telling the same story. But do you always think it will be a narrative? That is so natural to you that maybe it will be.
I don't know. I mean, I think most of my poetry comes from my interactions with the natural world. I mean, I guess I'm a little mystical in my approach, but when I don't like being cooped up inside. I need to move, as you've noticed, and I get so much sustenance, like the bees. I get sustenance from the plants, from the leaves, from the trees, from the way the wind moves the leaves, and the language that the whole earth is speaking, every living thing, and even the rocks, even the dirt, the stars in the sky, we're all connected. I feel very connected. So my poems always come out of that connection. I'm just kind of an antenna.
You are kind of an antenna, and we want to see what is calling in. Give us two together.
Okay.
Set them up.
All right. This next one is called Kutati. It's in a collection of eco poetry called Fire and Rain, Eco Poetry of California. And Kutati is where I lived for many years. All my life, I've dreamed of tilling such soil, sandy loam that yields to the shovel as readily as powdered chocolate to the spoon, as receptive as the womb of a teenage girl, soil that wants to be impregnated with the seeds I want to grow, Genovese basil, twining peas, and lettuce in a row, soil that snuggles up against the roots of tomatoes, black crim, and brandywine. Drink of me, the soil says. Cling to me. Wrap your legs around me early in the morning as the sun rises and the rooster crows and the birds start to sing.
My favorite, when the birds start to sing. Let's have another.
Okay, this next one was written also in Sonoma County in Kutati during COVID, which I actually, lockdown wasn't so bad for me. I didn't mind it. And this one is called Pandemic Pumpkins. Yesterday I saw the first paddle-like pale green leaves of the Cinderella pumpkin pushed up from the hilly mounds I made as graves for one of last year's gourds that went to rot before it could be used. The English peas I'd planted on top had come up first, as delicate as pen and ink fairies, tendrils blindly curling forth to find support for their limbs. On my hands and knees, I cleared the ground of weeds and added a row along the fence of sunflower seeds. Though their fruit and flowers are still months away, my pumpkins are already fat and dazzling orange in the mind's eye. The sunflower is yellow against the late summer sky. Seeds are hard to come by now. The sunflowers long past their use-by date. But still, any time a dried-up seed manages to germinate and grow, flower and thrive, it's truly a miracle. Who's to say a seed won't wait 3 years or even 10? Seed banks count on some of them possessing the biological patience to stay viable, on pause, till they're embraced by dirt, again licked to life by water, and awakened from enchanted sleep by sunlight and heat. I'm witness to this resurrection every day of my gardening season. How can I not believe that life will triumph over lockdown and decay?
Well, I know what you write about, and I know what you love, and I know that you want to write always. But what do you want from poetry?
Oh, poetry has always been such a gift to me since the age of 9. I couldn't ask anything more than what poetry has already given me, because poetry has been my lifeboat. Poetry has saved my life again and again. At times when I've felt despair about life, about my life, about my personal life, about the political situation, whatever it is, I've been able to climb into that little lifeboat made of words, and it keeps me above the waves. It keeps me from drowning. I had a lot of unhappiness, there was a lot of dysfunction in my family of origin, violence and abuse, and poetry, novels, poetry, stories, language was what kept me alive, and it still keeps me alive. I couldn't be alive without it.
And from your novels?
Well, it's the same thing. The novels were, I mean, several of them are historical fiction, as you know, that take place in other centuries and on other continents, other countries, and other landscapes. And the novels were a magic door. I could go through the door and walk into another world. And I wasn't a prisoner in my world anymore, that world where, you know, especially of childhood, where I had no control over what was going on. I couldn't save my parents. I couldn't save my brother or my sister. But I could put my fingers on that handle of the door and turn it, and it would open. And, it was like, I don't know what, like Alice in Wonderland or The Wizard of Oz. It was some magical thing. It was a transformative experience that would take me to other places.
Well, not only that, but you have the discipline. I have never known a writer, and I've met a lot of them, who is preoccupied 24 hours a day with conjuring, incubating, igniting, furthering, promoting, wishing. It is a life force that I think I take a break from it, but I've never seen you take a break from it. So it is you. It's truly your life's blood.
I don't take any credit for it. I don't think I have discipline. I mean, it's just, it's the urge to stay alive. It's the urge to survive that keeps me at it.
The intensity is there in the passion. So let's hear more passion, please.
Okay. This one also involves bees. We used to have an outdoor shower at the place, the little farm in Cotati where we lived. And I would shower outside just about every day, which you can do in all weather in California. And this is called The Bees and I. The bees and I share a place on the patio where a flurry of peppermint all in bloom brushes my knees when I shower. Each tiny, pale lavender flower is an offering to these agricultural workers who gather the pollen and bring it home to their queen. I soap up gingerly, as attentive to the bees as they are, I hope, oblivious of me. One false move might result in pain on some vulnerable part of my body, and death for the bee, unlucky enough to believe that I meant to harm him. We're both drones, he and I, doing our best to survive the work we're called to do, both of us gathering as much of the sweetest stuff as we can before we're through.
Love that one. I love that one. What's a typical writing day like?
Well, okay. Typically, my very sweet husband gets up and actually makes me a cup of tea and brings it to the bedside. And without speaking, this is the best kind of day, without saying a word or hearing a word, I just try to connect with where I was when I was asleep and dreaming. I open my notebook and I hope, I sort of pray for a few words to start out. And once I have that, the little end of the ribbon, I start reeling it in. Those words, I take them in and they are attached to other words. And that's the beginning.
And then, so you, just for practical purposes and logistically, you begin writing in bed.
I do.
And then you get up. Is there another time that you go to your, for instance, I write in the mornings, and I'm very disciplined about that. So you go to your office, and is there like after breakfast you do again, another session? Are the nights better for you? What is your MO?
Well, when I'm, you know, on a writing jag, I try to write in all available time, you know. So, you know, I try to be a responsible partner. So I do those breakfast dishes after my husband has made breakfast. And then I go off to the writing room. and I sit and I try to find that place again, just the end of the thread. I find it again.
So you don't start with images, collecting images or collecting remarks or taking note of things you've observed?
Not so much. More, I guess I'm a little bit of an unconscious writer. Sometimes if I'm feeling, if there aren't any words or phrases that are singing to me inside my head, I need to go outside because nature always gives me the words, the ideas, the metaphors. There, it's always there. So I just try to listen really hard. I listen to the leaves as they're, you know, rustling as I go by. I listen to the birds a lot. The birds speak
the
to
birds.
Me. And those bunnies that we have along our road.
Did you have them in California?
Not the same birds and not the same
Not the same bunnies.
No.
Let us hear a end product of all this conscious thinking, a poem.
Okay. Well, this one is called No Voice Inside. It's sort of a voice about aging and being at peace. No voice inside. If we were oak trees, rooted to one place, our movements too slow to perceive, hikers along the trail would pause and read our secret history in the contortions caused by obsolete impediments, cleared, burned up, or decomposed. The relationships that made us grow away from the sun, tortuously twisting to find it again. Lightning strikes that left us scarred and maimed. Young love's initials carved into our very skin, as faint as the tracery of worms now. No voice inside would wish for unmarked beauty in place of such a silhouette against the sky.
Give us those last two lines again.
No voice inside would wish for unmarked beauty in place of such a silhouette against the sky.
Silhouette against the sky. Let's hear more. More, please.
This one's a more personal poem, which draws on some of my childhood stuff. And I wrote it after I had cataract surgery and could suddenly see the world much more clearly and colors much more intensely. This is called Where We Keep Our Fears. With the lens of my right eye removed, replaced with something not me, will I learn to unsee the sight of my father's temple throbbing? It was our own early warning system that the ground beneath our feet was about to buckle and sway. Earthquakes are familiar to those growing up in LA, and yet I only remembered when one had started again. The windows rattling in their frames, my soft-spoken father possessed by rage, his long-fingered hands that soothed my hurts and smoothed my long brown hair contorted into fists. He never hit me. Behind the closed door where he made me wait, I heard my mother's cries and felt the thud of his clenched hand on her flesh. Earthquakes in Southern California endure from 10 to 30 seconds, that is to say, forever, in that pitch-dark place where I still try to hide from the betrayal I know will happen again, sooner or later, until I'm reborn with new eyes that never had to learn to be afraid.
You know, those poems really transcend space and time, because I was wondering the kind of writer. I've always known you as a Bay Area as a California writer. You're known to be that. And now you live on the East Coast. And I was wondering how that would affect your writing, which it's bound to, because it's a shift of energy. But there is the interior life will always remain as the same, do you think?
Well, unless I have a brain transplant or something.
So you don't think that you'll write differently, even though it may be evocative from memory. Living where you're looking out a different window would make a different poem?
Well, looking out a different window always does make a different poem, and being in a different landscape, you know, if one stays open, if the channels stay open, it has to make different poems because we have to be receptive. It's like visiting in another country and speaking another language. It's hearing the swirl of energy of nature's language all around, and nature expresses itself in different dialects and different places. So I'm a big believer in learning the local language. So I'm trying to learn the language of the East Coast. The hardest part of it, I find, is the language of winter. Last winter, we had snow wrapped in ice and day upon day upon day of completely inhospitable cold. I sort of felt like I had died and gone to some freezing version of hell. It was really hard. I couldn't go outside, and I was starving. It was like being in an airless environment. I need nature, and I think nature needs me too.
And we need another poem.
All right.
This is Barbara Quick at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
This is called Meditation on the Nature of Time. Can I speak of stars after all these years of poets gathering bright bouquets of words and rhymes, evoking how it feels to stand beneath the swirling constellations? Now that science tells us that dinosaurs didn't disappear, but evolved into birds. Which bright stars peeking out from in between the moon-swept clouds are actually extinct now? Their light and afterlife as moving as a symphony whose web of notes, well played, still squeezes tears from human eyes long after the composer's heart stops beating and his flesh and bones lie buried underground. Looking up, I wonder if this moment, in which I feel so vividly alive, is only a recollection of my future self at the moment of my death. Is this starlight from a star already dead? Is the touch of your warm, rough hands against my hungry skin a moment I am savoring from a place far away where memories masquerade as real life? I am being pulled feet first from out between my mother's legs in the same instant that my son feels all warmth and life abandoning the soft flesh of my ancient hand. Who knows what I'll become then? What light of mine might linger? What essence of my lumbering self might yet evolve into a creature that can fly?
How do you believe that you trust the pen so much?
How do I trust the pen so much?
Yeah, I've seen you at a writer's retreat come down with 10 pages that you did in the last hour, which flowed. I mean, they literally flowed from you, and it's like you have a writing without fear, because that can't happen if you're fearful. So do you think that you trust and that you have courage in your own ability? Or no control over it? Or
I just have gratitude. I mean, the pen is part of my antenna apparatus, I think. It must be. I can't imagine not writing, because it would be like I don't know, putting a gun to my head, giving up, saying, forget about it. You know, it's hopeless. You know, I am a very optimistic person by nature, and I'm a romantic person by nature, and I'm a fiction writer. I always say that that's it's a formula for a romantic disaster. But and I've had many lives in this lifetime. I hope I'll continue to. I hope I'll even, you know, I mean, I hope I'll have many, many more poems. I hope I'll have several more novels that will come out of my pen. And I'll write with gratitude just as long as I can. I mean, how lucky am I, Grace, to have this life? And how lucky am I to have someone like you as a champion of my writing? You have been a miracle
you
in my life.
You have many, many fans. I am just one of a cult. So if you were not a writer, what do you think your profession would be?
Well, I started out wanting to be an actress, and I have had a lot of theater training. I did from the age of 9 to the age of 17. I did that every summer very intensively. I did.
So you think you'd be on the stage?
No, because I didn't have the right talent to do it. I didn't have a big enough voice, and I wasn't pretty enough. I mean, it wasn't a, you know, ethnic looks were not in then. I mean, it was a time when being blonde and freckled and having a little turned up nose and being a little chubby, you know, was the thing.
It seems we're back there again.
maybe we are.
I thought you were going to say you'd be a dancer.
Well, I also knew, I recognized the limit of my talent there. I love dance, and I've always danced, and I continue to dance whenever I can. But I wound up doing Brazilian dance because I couldn't do ballet because I have zero turnout. Even though I have the sort of build for it, short-waisted, long legs, long neck, I couldn't do splits to save my life. I had no elevation. And in terms of modern dance, I was very uncomfortable working on the floor. I couldn't do it. So, I mean, I did every other kind of dance. I did African dance. I did tap.
But we have to remember that when we went to ask you to dance, we will not put you on the floor.
Good.
We know your limitations.
Thank you.
So before we have a final poem, what do you think the word devotion means?
That's a very big question, Grace. Devotion, I think it means commitment, total, unstinting, unselfish commitment. It's about generosity of spirit, finding that most generous place, most empathic place in oneself, and seeking it in others. And this is, I believe, what our world needs desperately. This has been our failure so far as a species to evolve wisdom and empathy and compassion.
And you think that's devotion?
I do. And I think if we did that, we would actually save the world, save this gorgeous planet of ours, and make it a good place for the children and grandchildren and the generations to come in every country in the world.
What do you think spirit means?
I think spirit is all that we don't see, but it's all around us all the time. And if we listen, we hear it, we feel it with our senses. We are as much spirit as we are bodies. Bodies is a part of it.
Let us have a final poem.
All right, I'll try. All right, I'm going to read a poem called The Bread My Mother Gave Me. She apologized that it was probably stale, but how could it not be when handed to me in a dream on a visit from the afterlife? It had honey baked into the middle and was more delicious than any bread I've ever tasted. I told her how grateful I felt for this sustenance from her, however late it came, for the loving way she looked at me across that distance between life and death, a hand's breadth between us as I received that holy bread and ate to fill that hungry place inside me.
We are the beneficiaries for that. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress and the studios of the Library of Congress. And that was the voice of Barbara Quick. We want to tell you that the program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, and the post-production is by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, by the Bravada Foundation of the Logan family, by friends of the program, Natalie Canivore and Sandy Jackson-Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.